This is episode 36 of The Fifth Estate, Jonah Goldberg, and the legacy of Barack Obama.
Folks, Neil Dewing here to tell you about our friends at Casper. Casper is a sleep brand that created one perfect mattress sold directly to consumers, eliminating commission-driven inflated prices. Its award-winning sleep surface was developed in-house, has a sleek design, and is delivered in a small how-did-they-do-that-size box. In addition to the mattress, Casper also offers an adaptive pillow and soft, breathable sheets. The mattress industry has forced consumers into paying notoriously high markups. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing that savings directly to the consumer. The Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. An in-house team of engineers spent thousands of hours developing the Casper. Its supportive memory foam offers a sleep surface that's got just the right sink and just the right bounce. Plus, its breathable design sleeps cool to help you regulate your temperature throughout the night. With over 20,000 reviews and over 4.8 out of 5 stars, it is quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. Buying a Casper mattress is completely risk-free. Casper offers free delivery and free returns to the US and Canada with a 100-night home trial. That's 100 nights risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend a third of your life on it. Now, a special offer for our listeners. Get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/fifth and using fifth as your promo code. That's www.casper.com/fifth, promo code fifth.
All right, it is time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. I'm Jay Caruso, along with my co-host, Mr. Neil Dewing. How are you?
Jay, I'm ready to do the dang thing.
All right. Well, before we get started, as always, we tell you fine folks who are listening that if you like what you're listening to, if you like what you hear, please go out to iTunes, leave us a review, subscribe to the podcast, tell your friends to subscribe, tell your parents to subscribe, tell everybody to subscribe.
Yes, please do. Just spread the news far and wide. Jay Caruso and Neil Dewing are making a fantastic podcast, and we're just giving it away practically. So, you know, you really have no excuse. It's the bare minimum you can do.
Yeah. I mean, you never get, you know, you can always get your money back if you don't like it. So, right? All right. So, we've had a couple episodes where we talked about stuff with Donald Trump, and, you know, so I don't want to talk about that anymore. But we have left, you know, a presidency behind, a two-term presidency in Barack Obama. And so we decided we wanted to talk about his legacy and what kind of presidency he has had. And we've asked and we've chased and we finally got him to join us from National Review. Jonah Goldberg is here with us. Jonah, thank you for coming on.
It's great to be here. And I assume that now that I am here, you will release my child from that motel.
Yes, we promise. Well, once we're done, we got about 45 minutes.
Goes.
Yeah.
Just make with the jokes, sir.
Yeah, we'll check back in 45 minutes and then we'll see. And if all goes well, I'll make the call and we'll take care of it. So
I appreciate that.
All right.
You.
Well, Jonah, I mean, our audience is gonna pretty much know who you are, but still, if you want to kind of give us an update on anything new you've got going on. New pets, new dogs. We like seeing the photos of the dogs. What's going on with you at this stage of your life with the new administration?
Well, I spend my days on Amazon searching for deals on hemlock, and I am still in the throes of book hell. I told my editor I had to send what I had so far, the incomplete manuscript, in just because I needed a break from it, and she needed to start looking at the fresh hell that I'm sending her. And so that came in at 216,000 words, which is too long, as they say in publishing.
That's a big one.
And the one of the reasons why I had to get out of my life is because the revenues are after me. I'm being audited. Awesome. And what else? Oh, you may have noticed, I don't know if you pay close attention to the news, but I am at somewhat cross purposes with some of the people on the right about the state of politics in America today. And that's always a source of frustration and tension. And for those who are truly followers of my scribblings, I have a semi-wild dog named Zoe. She's a Carolina dog, which is also known as the American Dingo. And she simply refuses to be what practitioners of veterinary science and zoology call a good dog. And I have another dog named Pippa, who is a English Springer Spaniel, who would be lucky to get the 250 points on the SAT if she just filled out the ovals for her name. But she's very sweet, and it's just kind of funny because I got this white trash swamp dog that's constantly trying to kill squirrels, rabbits, and everything else listed on the crate for the Tasmanian devil. And then I got this sort of very waspy kind of noodle salad dog, and it's kind of like Zoe is Daryl from The Walking Dead, and Pippa is the dumb daughter from Downton Abbey. And it's just it's a weird life I've got going right now. So everything's pretty hectic and stressed, and I if I start just rambling incoherently, and start talking about how I smell burnt hair, it's probably because I'm long overdue for some kind of seizure.
Okay. That's sort of just like reading the G file, then.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, excellent. Okay. Well, you know, precisely because everybody's, you know, at cross purposes with one another, and everything's so very hectic, we thought it would be nice to take a retrospective here and pick up our old habit of criticizing President Obama mercilessly. So that's
what criticize.
Well, I know, right? So we did want to get your read on a few of his lasting contributions to American society and government. Let's just start with domestic policy. You know, we've got taxes, education, energy. You know, what do you see as Obama's signature domestic achievement?
Huh. That's an interesting question. Well,
is achievement the right word?
Yeah, I mean, he did things. He moved a lot of paper around. My understanding is that he lost something like $6 billion from the Education Department. And for all the talk about how they did some good things in education, I don't know that anyone's going to remember that as some sort of great leap forward in American, you know, literacy or pedagogy or anything like that. He's killed an enormous number of really cool birds with his windmills. What else has he done? I mean, on the domestic front, it's hard to say. He raised some taxes. He signed on to the sequester, which from a green-eyed shade point of view, you know, I have libertarian friends who don't really much care about military spending, or if they care about it, they care about it going down. So in that sense, you know, that led to deficits and debt either going down or moderating in the rate of increase. I think, you know, to be fair, one could say, history yet remains to be definitively written on this, but I think you can make the case that regardless of the sort of economic arguments for a second, psychologically, his reaction to the financial crisis was a positive one. And I'm reluctant to say that only because I think it could have been done so much better. I think the economics were weird and bad, but the stimulus was done stupidly. Mm-hmm. I mean, the idea that you could drop $800 billion in sugar and not get a better sugar rush to the economy than what we got is kind of astounding to me. But at the same time, given that markets are run more by psychology, in particularly during panics, he was reassuring. The elites wanted him to do the kind of stuff that he was doing, and therefore pandering to sort of Wall Street elites and global elites and Davos elites and all that kind of stuff was, you can make the case that whether or not it was good economics, it was the right thing to do. Again, I think you could have done it better and still pandered to those guys.
Yeah.
But I think historians are going to be pretty favorable towards him on that. I think historians, particularly if historians tend to be the kind of sort of left of center types that they currently are going to praise his quote-unquote saving of Detroit, right? I mean, it's sort of like the New Deal, right? FDR did a lot of really stupid things in the New Deal, but they were perceived as doing good things, and that in and of itself had positive effects. And to this day, historians get very persnickety when you point out that huge chunks of the New Deal were counterproductive, prolonged the New Deal and all the rest, but they are enamored with the idea that the president or the state is the savior during these times. And so they credit the New Deal with a lot of things it didn't actually do. So I think there's going to be a lot of that sort of stuff for Obama for a very long time coming. I think accomplishing being the first black president will, yeah, which I don't think is the accomplishment that some people think it is, but it is an important thing in American history, will be seen as an historic accomplishment. And, you know, by not being George W. Bush, which was really, yeah, his mandate, and he fulfilled it on day one, that was a major accomplishment.
Well, I think you raise a very interesting point about the psychological aspects here, because, you know, we've got, I remember we all chuckled about how the media compared Barack Obama to Mr. Spock, you know, that cool, calm, logical, when, I mean,
yeah,
a lot
no
of,
drama,
a lot
Obama,
of the
that kind
policy
of
decisions were emotionally based, you know, as it turns out. But I think that you do raise a very, very interesting point that, yeah, maybe we did need someone who was a little bit detached, a little bit aloof, someone who wouldn't run around like a chicken with his head cut off. One of the things that I recall from the 2008 campaign, and, you know, nothing against John McCain, but I thought that his suspension of his campaign looked a little frantic, a little bit too reactive, you know. That kind of tone that Obama set throughout his presidency of the detached person, I think was helpful in navigating that financial crisis. Now, not so much in other ways, but definitely that's a great point. That's a great point.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things to think about Obama is just simply that, excuse me, you know, there was a lot of talk under Bush about how he was essentially, you know, a culture war figure, right? That he, either you loved him or you hated him. He represented Texas. He spoke American. There was all that kind of thumb-sucking punditry going on under Bush. And I think there was a lot of accuracy to it, that if you were sort of a cosmopolitan, you know, New York, L.A. type, there was just something about Bush you could not stand. There was something similar, not quite the same, going on about Bill Clinton. He was a kid of the 60s. He had that certain smug, I'm smarter than you, baby boomer mentality. And he was a culturally divisive figure just by his personality. What I think a lot of people on the left failed to appreciate about Barack Obama is that he was every bit as much of a sort of cultural avatar for a certain kind of smug Daily Show liberalism as George W. Bush was for sort of Fox and Friends country music fans. And that I think is a problem going forward, is that I wrote about this recently in a column, is that the culture wars have now encroached upon the presidency itself. And you no longer have these people who are sort of like Eisenhower or even Papa Bush, who were kind of above these sort of left-right, for want of a better word, blue state, red state kind of disagreements, part of the old patrician elite. You know, Eisenhower, you know, he liberated Europe, which is kind of cool. Everyone liked him. The Democrats wanted him to run as a Democrat. We don't have that now. What we have now is sort of like what you had in England on the eve of the Glorious Revolution, where if a Protestant is on the throne, Catholics not only don't like it, they feel threatened. They feel as if their worldview, their way of life, the future of their country, the future of their children is under siege. And similarly, if a Catholic is on the throne, the Protestants feel we're losing our country, we're going back to popery and all of the rest. The Oval Office is kind of like the throne of England now. And so Donald Trump is in there. And again, this gets kind of confusing because the guy is from Manhattan. And in a lot of ways, he really is a representative of blue state cultural liberalism. But because he was always sort of a populist within New York City world, you know, he was more comfortable talking to the doormen and the construction workers and reading the New York Post than he was at the Met. He kind of cuts across some weird cultural fault lines. But clearly, the culture is adapting to this. And now the sort of right-wing populist element on the conservative side, which is very strong, very ascendant, sees him as a representation, their warrior, their paladin, their anointed champion for their battle in the culture wars. And the left, which is just in a bowel-stewing panic, sees him as, you know, the Stygian creature that emerges from the, you know, when you rip the seventh seal of the apocalypse. And I don't think that's going to change for a while, because all of our politics stuff has really become downstream of these larger sort of cultural antagonisms.
So speaking in that respect, let's talk a little bit about not so much policy, but his effect, you know, in terms of the culture. Barack Obama, for better or for worse, became the first president to be the social media president, to, you know, look how many times he appeared on shows like Jimmy Kimmel and late night shows. And then, of course, the BuzzFeed thing with the selfies and all these other pictures. And, you know, what is that going to have any lasting effect on the presidency now? I mean, are people going to expect that? You know, because if you say you go back to like Papa Bush or even George W. Bush, I mean, I just, you know, George W. Bush would sometimes be, you know, filmed dancing kind of like a goof. But, you know, the idea of him sitting there in the offices of the White House with BuzzFeed and, you know, making faces into a mirror and point, you know, having a selfie stick just doesn't seem like his kind of thing.
No, I think that's right. I mean, you can always sort of play the video backwards and find precedents going all the way back. You know, you can say it's all Nixon's fault because he said sock it to me on Laughing, or you can say it's Bill Clinton's fault for talking about his underwear on MTV and playing the saxophone on Arsenio Hall. But the reality is that while those are precedents, what's also happened is that the trend has accelerated exponentially. And so Obama was very comfortable as a pop culture figure, particularly among sort of elite, smug, you know, pop culture crowd. And Donald Trump is a pop culture figure. I mean, you know, he was a pop culture figure before he became president. Barack Obama became a pop culture figure by being president, and they're sort of different things. But I think that, you know, part of the lasting problem that Obama has had on the culture is it's very much, he was very consistent with the sort of what I guess Ross Douthat calls the Samantha Bee problem, right? Is that, you know, Barack Obama came into office more ideological and arrogant than any president I can remember, while at the same time claiming that he was entirely unideological. And so what you get is this weird sort of, I mean, I'm, you know, every right-wing pundit has their weird obsessions, and one of mine is the pernicious influence of philosophical pragmatism on American life. We don't need to get into the weeds on that, but if you poke me too much, I will. But, you know, Obama insisted over and over and over again that he was a pragmatist and a problem solver, and he just wanted to do whatever works. The speech he gave on the eve of his first inauguration, where he said, we in America need a new declaration of independence from small-mindedness, bigotry, prejudice, and ideology.
Yeah.
And so for him, ideology belongs in that list of horribles, right? It is something that only people with disordered minds or disordered souls have, is ideology. He was science. He was based on science and facts and sound science. And the this accelerate this gave a cue to forces that were already in the culture of the sort of John Stewart idea that anybody who disagreed with liberal conventional wisdom didn't just have a different opinion. They had to be sort of ensorcelled by ideology, confused, deranged. You know, Paul Krugman loved to say that facts have a liberal bias, you know, and that he wasn't ideological. And that approach empowered a lot of lowbrow and middlebrow entertainers to heap nothing but scorn on whatever you want to call it, conservatives, red state Americans, traditional America, however you want to put it. And they, it never occurred to them that the people they were scorning and ridiculing might notice and take offense at it. And so I think in a lot of ways, the blowback for one, or the backlash that Donald Trump tapped into was, you know, was nurtured by Barack Obama for 8 years.
Yeah, you know, you lay it out like that. I mean, it is. I wonder, here's a question that occurred to me. How much is to what degree is Barack Obama a victim of the expectations that were placed upon him, the unrealistic expectations? You know, one of my favorite quotes from the last few years comes from our friend John Gabriel, and it's just this fantastic observation. My favorite part about the Obama era is all the racial healing. That's something that it kind of sums it up.
Yeah.
Barack Obama was going to reverse the rise of the oceans. Barack Obama was going to usher in an era of racial harmony and equality. At long last, our racial sins will be forgiven. Well, no, at the end of his 8 years, we were more divided than we had been at the beginning. It felt that way to me, and I'm sure to many others. But so I wonder, what would you say? To what degree was Obama a victim of the expectations that were placed upon him rather than his own ideological pretension?
Yeah, I don't want to pull a Newt Gingrich and attack the questioner. But
but may I have another?
But part of the problem with your question is you conflated some things, right? You, on the one hand, you said you began and you ended with how much is he a victim of the expectations that were placed upon him? But the middle part, the middle arc of your question talked about how he was going to make the oceans turn around. Well, no one expected him to make the oceans turn around until he friggin' said he would. You know,
I mean,
you can't come riding in on your friggin' Pegasus promising to convert unicorn poop into renewable energy and make the oceans recede, and then all of a sudden say it's unfair to have high expectations. You know, this guy ran implicitly, and he allowed and encouraged people to explicitly paint him as a friggin' messiah. You know, remember the guy from the San Francisco Chronicle calling him a light worker, some sort of charmed, you know, Jedi-like being with more midichlorians than the rest of us and all that kind of nonsense. There was a great website, I don't know if it's still up, called Is Obama the Messiah? That just collects these sorts of sayings from prominent people. What's his name? Spike Lee talking about future historians will refer to everything as, you know, AO and BO for after Obama and before Obama. You know, he's supposed to be this incredibly world historical figure. And Obama, you know, he can, in a lawyerly way, defend himself against the charge that people had too high expectations of him. But he had no problem with having people set those expectations high for him when it was to his advantage or simply when it was friggin' flattering.
Jesus was a community organizer. Remember that one?
Yeah, I mean, all that sort of nonsense. And so the part of the real problem with... And so, yes, there were unfair expectations on Obama. One of the things I really resent are all the people, all the liberals who winked and nodded and said that this would be so good for racial healing and all the rest. And then the second he's elected, say, we never said racism was going to go away. We never said this problem was going to go away. And they kind of did. But I think that if we're going to get to the heart of it, the fundamental flaw, and I think, and I, you know, I only do this once every 4,000 years. I'm going to give credit to what's her name? Maureen Dowd. But the fundamental problem with Barack Obama is he thought he was too good for the job. He thought he was too good for the grubby bit of politics. And so all of his major legislative accomplishments happened in the first 2 years when he had control of Congress. You know, they rammed stuff through. He farmed all that stuff out to the House, to Reid and Pelosi. And you talk to people on the Hill, you talk to people in Washington, including Democrats. Obama just thought that because he was so right, that because he thought he had all of the answers and that his view, like remember the first meeting, that big famous meeting about Obamacare where they had the Republicans and the Democrats come to the White House and what's his name? Eric Cantor says, starts making an argument about, you know, the problem with the Obamacare proposal or the stimulus. I can't remember which one it was. And Obama immediately shoots back, look, the campaign's over. We don't have time for talking points. And that's how Obama basically, that's what he means when he says liberation, Declaration of Independence from ideology. Because he thinks he doesn't have an ideology, this is what pragmatists always do, is they take their own ideology, claim that it is science, and then claim that everybody else who has a different ideology is ensorcelled by ideology. And so he says everything that anyone, you know, like I remember his first press conference, he said something along the lines of, look, I'm open to ideas from Republicans, from Democrats. I don't care where they, liberal, conservative, I don't care where they come from, you know, just so long as they work. But the one thing you shouldn't tell me is government shouldn't do this. And, you know, that's his ideology, is that the government is the answer to all these things. You read his second inaugural. His whole vision of the country is of the state and the individual with nothing but a barren wasteland of Herbert Spencer and dog-eat-dog survival of the fittest competition. And that's the essence of life as Julia, right? It's this chick, Julia, whose entire life, you know, I mean, the creepiest sentences ever uttered in a political ad ever, in print or verbally, were the on those panels. The beginning of every panel, it said, under President Obama, Julia gets a student loan, and under President Obama this, and under President Obama that. And then there was, under President Obama, Julia decides to have a child. You know, that's creepy shit. And yes. And that, but that was his vision. And so the problem was, is that he was fundamental in a certain way. I mean, I think he had a strong work ethic in certain regards. I'm sure he stayed up late. I'm sure he read a lot of stuff. I'm sure he had big meetings and had interesting conversations and all that kind of nonsense. But he was lazy in the sense that he really just didn't want to call members of Congress and work with them. He didn't want a politic. He thought that was beneath him. He had this sort of monarchical view of himself and thought that his ministers should all deal with this stuff. But at the same time, he didn't fundamentally believe in compromise. And so he left himself with very little political room. You know, if the Republicans had voted en masse unanimously against LBJ's first big stimulus program thing in similar circumstances, you know, Paul Ryan and Eric Cantor would wake up the next morning with their favorite horse's head in their bed. But Obama didn't want to do that stuff. He thought he could just rally the people. And so that was his solution to everything was, you know, give another speech.
Right.
Give another, you know, and he, it turns out that he had no coattails. None of his endorsements ever worked. He couldn't sell anything. He gave something like 56 speeches on Obamacare in his first year, never moved the dial and made the thing popular. But he was so convinced of his skills and was so convinced that the people who were telling him he was awesome were right that he never thought that, oh, you know, it turns out the politics is more about persuading people behind the scenes and politicking and all the rest. And he had none of that in him. And that's why he had, and ultimately he lost House, he lost the Senate, he lost, you know, 1,000 Democratic office holders. He ended up having to do everything by executive order because he could only do stuff with his pen and on his phone because he didn't care about doing real politics.
Right. It often seemed like he seemed perplexed by the fact that, you know, wait, I gave a speech about this. How come nobody's doing it? How come nobody's doing what I want? You know,
he couldn't. Yeah, I mean, one of the tells
he
was,
seemed to be flummoxed
to
by
say,
that.
As I said before, right? You always like, as I've said before, as I said at the time, and often it was a lie or a misrepresentation of what he said at the time.
Right.
But it's also like that tick of his where he says, let me be clear.
Mm-hmm.
My God, you know, why won't this country let this guy be clear? I mean, I used to scream it at the television. And that's because he just assumes that if you don't agree with him, you really weren't listening.
Okay, on that note, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back. We'll talk more with Jonah Goldberg right after a few words about our good friends over at Blue Apron. Let's face it, folks. Cooking, for a lot of people, can be a drag. But it doesn't have to be. And Blue Apron can help you with that. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone, even for people that can't cook. So if you're one of those people, you want good meals, you don't want something you're going to stick in a microwave, then Blue Apron is something that can help you out. Here's the best part. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. I've gotten these myself. Basically, it comes in a box. There's these big ice packets. All the food is fresh. They use great ingredients. And the food is really delicious. I've had a couple of the meals myself, and they're great, I'm telling you. And it's very easy to do. You don't have to know how to cook in order to do this. They give you, it comes with an instruction card that has photos and step-by-step instructions on what to do to make a great-tasting meal. Here are some of the upcoming meals that they're going to have, and this sounds really good. They have cashew chicken stir-fry with tango mandarins and jasmine rice, roasted pork with apple, walnut, and farro salad, and you can get an udon noodle soup with miso and soft-boiled eggs. There are so many different varieties of meals that you can get. It's very easy. If you don't like meat, you can cut out meat. If you don't like fish, you can cut out fish. It's up to you. You can even get vegetarian meals. So it's completely up to you. All right. So how do you take advantage of this? I'll tell you what. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/fifth. That's F-I-F-T-H, blueapron.com/fifth. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/fifth. All right, and we're back. So, Jonah, let's talk about what Barack Obama would consider his quote-unquote signature achievement and what he actually said was something that was better than being elected president was when he was able to put his signature on the Affordable Care Act. And you know, now we're in a point where, you know, hopefully it's going to be repealed. And he has said, you know, hey, if you can figure something out that's better, I'll be for it. But it's going to be interesting to see. I kind of get the feeling no matter what they do, it's not going to be as good as Obamacare. But what if we're looking, if we go 10, 15 years down the road, you know, just kind of looking ahead and just spitballing here, what is Obamacare going to be? You know, what is that? What effect is that going to have on his legacy?
It remains to be seen. You know, I think politically, it's a mess. You know, I mean, it's really difficult to predict because when you take over one seventh or one sixth, whatever it is now, of the economy, and people, you know, acclimate to it, then any change you make to it, you get the blame for. And that was a problem for Democrats for the last couple of years. And now going forward, it's going to be a problem for Republicans. And the problem, I mean, the heart of the political problem is, you know, if you find someone with a knife plunged into their chest, the smartest medical thing isn't necessarily to pull the knife out. And you can't pull the knife out of Obama. You know, you can't pull the knife that is Obamacare out of the economy willy-nilly. And so a lot of it kind of depends on how much, I think, people are going to be able to claim legitimately or not that whatever if the replacement is good, how much of it was built upon Obamacare rather than a replacement of Obamacare. If it's not good, there will be a massive political journalistic cottage industry to create nostalgia for Obamacare, right? If this goes badly,
I cannot imagine what that looks like.
Well,
remember the days when our premiums would only go up by 5 to 10% every single year.
Yeah, I can tell you a part of what it'll look like. Fast forward to the nominating convention for Elizabeth Warren's campaign in 2020, and they will have, you know, a parade of kids like the cast from that Shriners commercial, the Shriners Children's Hospital commercial, on talking about how they used to have coverage until the Republicans took it away, how their kid used, you know, was getting chemotherapy and now he gets a stick of gum because of the Republicans. I mean, there's going to be a lot of, it's going to be demagogic and awful, but I mean, it'll work. And
I didn't mean to cut you off. I just saw an ad the other day with a wounded veteran who had an amputated leg talking about taking away his health care.
Yeah.
So
it's going to be ugly because, again, it all happens against the backdrop of this sort of soupy culture war where everyone gets to pick their anointed victims and no one's allowed to, you know, contradict a victim about anything. I mean, so I honestly don't know. I mean, I think that, again, historians, whatever happens to Obamacare, if it's gotten rid of, historians will say it was 5 seconds from working perfectly. And if we end up having some form of socialized medicine going forward, he'll get credit for having, you know, touched the third rail or loosened the jar of the health care, of peanut butter health care or whatever. I mean, that kind of thing. So I don't know. I mean, I'm pretty mad at the Republicans who have been talking and demonizing and attacking, rightly by my opinion, Obamacare for, 7 years now.
Right.
And they do, you know, and it's fine to point out that the problem is, you know, it's fine to point out that, well, they have lots of plans. They just haven't settled on one. Well, do you think maybe you should have? You know, I mean, I just, at some point that excuse, you know, that dog doesn't hunt for me after a while. And so the where I think the historians will have a point about Obamacare is that the second you and we used to make this point at NR a lot during the debates, the second you sort of convince people that the state has an obligation to provide you with health care, you take that entitlement and you pocket it. And when you pocket that entitlement, you fundamentally change the relationship between the citizen and the government in a way that I don't think is easily or ever reversed. And so conceptually, the idea of Obamacare, I think, is a lasting accomplishment because it established rhetorically and in law, you know, and thanks to the Supreme Court, definitely in law, this idea that the state can, first of all, forget healthcare, can mandate that you do things, you know, that can tell you you have to buy certain things. And in terms of the ratchet effect of the sort of the growth of the state, that's a really big deal. And he'll get to brag about that.
Well, on that distressing note, let's cast our gaze overseas to our foreign affairs and the legacy of Barack Obama's foreign policy, which, quick review, involved disengagement from the Bush era Middle East policy of prosecuting wars overseas. While I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, increasing the amount of drone strikes on individuals, including American citizens, while also seeing a real souring of relations with Russia and an inability to contest Russia as they exerted their influence across their sphere there. So Jonah, let's just focus on terrorism and the war on terror. What do you think Obama's legacy is going to be in that respect? What has he handed off to Donald Trump in terms of the situation? And what has he perhaps empowered Trump to do that we might not want him to do?
Golly. I think it is much easier to talk about Barack Obama's foreign policy legacy because basically it's all garbage.
All right, moving on.
And, so.
No, I'm just kidding.
I want to hear Jonas say more terrible things about it.
I think that, first of all, you know, as we all know, droning Americans overseas with Hellfire missiles and killing their families is just another word for those things that Americans do together, right? I mean, that was his understanding of government. And look, come on, I got no problem with droning people. The right people. let's make that clear. But I think that if I were writing a history about, let's assume I have some sense, which I don't necessarily, have some sense about where we are in 5 years or 10 years, I would be perfectly comfortable writing a history about how Barack Obama made the world a much, much more dangerous place, that he diminished America's standing around the world. I think that the way Donald Trump talks about NATO, the way Newt Gingrich talks about our NATO allies in the Baltics, I think the way Donald Trump has dealt with Australia and Mexico is all very, very bad. But you got to remember that this idea that America can't be counted on was really solidified in world opinion under Barack Obama. You know, just talk to the Czechs or Poles about the missile defense deal, right? Talk to the Iraqis about, you know, Obama's decision to bug out prematurely. Talk to the Iranians in the Green Revolution about how he threw them all under the bus so that he could get this sort of legacy building, craptacular Iranian deal. Barack Obama was given this gift by history when those green revolutions broke out, when the Arab Spring broke out, and he had a complete failure of the imagination, in large part because he comes from a school of the left that basically sees America as a force for ill around the world. And he would rather be a realist and talk to the mullahs in Iran and count on their word and believe that because his middle name was Hussein and he has a funny Klingon pronunciation of Pakistan, that somehow they would all sort of, you know, bend their will to his, and we would all be walking arm in arm towards the sunny uplands of history. And the reality is, if you wanted to sort of fix Iran, I'm not saying that we should have sent troops in or anything like that, but helping the Green Revolution would have been a step in a positive direction. It would certainly, even if it didn't succeed, it would impress the Iranian regime to understand that we're people willing to sort of screw with them. And but everywhere you look, Obama comes from a school of liberalism, says that it's better to be wrong in a big group than to be right alone. And the way that he has sort of denigrated the United States, denigrated our standing as a leader of a military coalition, is something that, you know, Trump inherits and makes worse. And this idea that somehow the Iranian deal was going to be this thing that was going to flip a switch and fix everything in the Middle East. Well, tell that to a 250,000 dead Syrians.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that has really scandalized me over the last couple of years is the rise of ISIS, and you know how that is almost a direct result of the destabilization that took place when we left that region. You know, some people would take it further back and say that we caused the destabilization in the first place, but when we left, that left a vacuum. I think it was an object lesson in, you know, what happens when you cede territory or cede the space from I wonder if you would agree. I mean, how much responsibility does Barack Obama share for the rise of ISIS not necessarily the atrocities that they perpetrated, but certainly the providing space for them to operate.
Well, I'm not going to pull a Trump and say he was the founder of ISIS. I think
no.
That's a bridge too far.
But is there a connection between his policies and the rise of ISIS, I guess?
Well, of course there is. I mean, sort of like I was saying about Obamacare, let's just say we were wrong to invade Iraq. I think that is a perfectly defensible and correct position, knowing what we know now, right? That if you could do it over again, would you do it? No, you wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
Or at least you would do it very differently, right? But sort of like I was saying with Obamacare, just because someone stabbed in the chest doesn't mean you fix them by pulling the knife out. And, you know, history has this weird way. We all think about how the present influences the future. We never really think about how the future influences the past. And I'll give you an example. Most of my life up until 1989, 1917 was like one of the most important dates of the 20th century, or maybe the most important date of the 20th century. You know, this was the day where the Soviet Union was created, the Bolsheviks took over, their long, inexorable march to world dominion and all the rest began then. The cold and personal forces of Marxist history were unleashed. And then in 1989, the Soviet Union collapses, and all of a sudden 1917 doesn't look that interesting anymore. It looks like the open parentheses in 1989 looks like the closed parentheses on an interesting historical chapter. On 9/11, all of a sudden, the 1922, when the Wahhabis took over Saudi Arabia, becomes a much more interesting date, or the whatever that date was when the forces of Christendom stopped the Ottomans in Vienna becomes this hugely important date that no one really knew. You know, everyone starts pulling down Bernard Lewis books and starts reading them because of 9/11. The fact is that Iraq could have still, when Obama was elected president, Iraq still could have been a positive chapter in American history if we saw the project through, right? If we had pulled troops out of Germany in 1945, who knows what Germany would have turned into, but we saw it through. Obama, what he did, his lasting legacy in terms of Iraq was to ensure for at least a very long time that the decision to go into Iraq would be remembered for all time as a mistake by pulling troops out, creating that vacuum, creating the opportunity for ISIS to rise, creating the instability that led to Syria. I don't know that you get what you got in Syria if we had still had, you know, a bunch of troops in Iraq. It certainly would have made Barack Obama's red line pronouncements a little more plausible. And so it is entirely possible still, though, I don't think this is likely. I think, you know, radical Islamic terrorism is a huge problem. It's a serious problem. Donald Trump should do what we have to do to defeat it. But unless he does something or his successors do something that actually creates a true civilizational World War III, where the Muslim world and the Western world fight a bloody existential war against each other, I don't think it's going to be that. But my point is that if it does turn into something like that, we may remember Iraq as sort of the Korean War or the Vietnam War was to the Cold War, a sort of badly botched but understandable conflict in the context of a much larger struggle. Obama didn't believe the larger struggle was there at all and thought we were the problem, not the solution to everything. And so he made Iraq a much more destabilized place, basically made it part of Iran's sphere of influence. And Donald Trump is inheriting a hot mess.
That he is. That's an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah, it's something that he is, you know, Donald Trump, of course, you know, it's one of the mainstays of his campaign was that he was going to take on ISIS. He was going to clean up the mess that Barack Obama had left. But let's take that a little bit and shift it to, you know, kind of bringing that back to the United States and areas where Barack Obama went after George W. Bush hard, especially with spying and, you know, warrantless wiretaps and things of that nature. all of these things, you know, you have all these people say it's so great that we have a presidency that's leaving that didn't have a scandal associated with it. And, you know, I always want to understand what their definition of scandal is. When you have situations where the president, you know, you had the IRS scandal targeting conservative groups, you had the president and the attorney general, you know, peeking into the phone records of journalists, naming one as a unindicted co-conspirator, you know, the list goes on, you know, expanding NSA powers to be able to look at phone records, all of these different things. And you know, of course, there's Fast and Furious and, of course, Benghazi. To say that this administration is, you know, is leaving without scandal seems to be kind of laughable, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what your rules about profanity are.
Go
on this
for
podcast.
It.
But it's just horseshit, you know. But what it demonstrates is the degree to which scandal is in the eye of the beholder, and the official beholders of the media really get to determine to a large extent what counts as a quote unquote real scandal. You know, people forget, you know, George W. Bush's 16 words about yellow cake from Africa was treated as an enormous scandal, right? The Valerie Plame thing was treated as an enormous scandal. And it was treated as an enormous scandal because the New York Times and the Washington Post and the mainstream networks and all the rest wanted it to be treated like an enormous scandal. It seems impossible to believe to me that you could take the list you just went through and assume that it happened under a Bush administration, that none of those things would be treated as a major scandal by the New York Times. I mean, it's ludicrous on its face. You look at the things that Donald Trump has done in his first 3 weeks, I think some of them definitely deserve criticism. But you would think, reading the New York Times or watching CNN, that literally every single day is a Watergate-level scandal. You know, the firing of the politically appointed ambassadors around the world, which pretty much every president does, was treated as this ominous sign about, you know, the takeover of our foreign policy, which, you know, is what a president does, is take over foreign policy. And so you go back and you look at the stuff on the merits. Obviously, you know, Benghazi, forget, there are several different things that could be called scandal in Benghazi. There was the lack of preparedness on 9/11. I mean, who knew that terrorists might do something on 9/11, right? I mean, that's such a weird idea.
Yeah. Odd.
So there was the lack of preparedness for it. There was the bad response to it. But then there was also the lying about it, right? It was caused by a video. It was this spontaneous movie review in Libya, which was nonsense. And there was also the way in which I think was the most outrageous thing about that whole episode. I mean, other than like Hillary Clinton lying to the parents and all that stuff, was the President of the United States in both the UN and in front of Congress, I think in front of Congress, I know at the UN, basically floated the idea that the real problem was free expression in the West. That basically it was the First Amendment that caused, you know, that killed Ambassador Stevens. And that kind of blame America first stuff is disgusting to me intellectually, but when you put it in the political context, particularly when you're doing it in a megaphone around the world, and you're basically saying, you know, we have to look inside ourselves and revisit our commitments to free speech, because maybe, you know, we need to give a heckler's veto to people, in arousing that debate. I mean, I remember listening to Diane Rehm's show where she had four people on all talking about how, you know, the First Amendment maybe is outdated, and we have to deal with the fact that some of the things we do here might offend, you know, Islamists. I'm like, well, look, I don't want to enrage peaceful, nonviolent, non-terrorist Muslims any more than anybody else. I believe in good manners. I think burning the Quran is an asinine thing to do, but the idea that somehow, because a bunch of murderous barbarians kill Americans overseas in a terrorist attack, that we need to sort of rethink our commitment to liberty here at home is outrageous. But the New York Times doesn't hear that from him, and it doesn't, and it agrees with them. But when, you know, Donald Trump says something about revisiting libel laws, which I don't think we should do, they say, oh my gosh, he wants to repeal the First Amendment. Hillary Clinton ran on amending the First Amendment. You know, that was one of her four core campaign promises, and one got their panties in a bunch about it.
I forgot about that. Oh,
some of the double standard shit drives me absolutely batty. What I think is a problem, and I know you guys want to stick to Obama, but one of the problems we're undergoing right now on the right is people on the right are understandably livid about the double standard. And they're saying, you know, why didn't you make a fuss about executive orders when Obama did this? Or why didn't you make a fuss when Obama did that? And they're absolutely right that the New York Times should have made a fuss when Obama did those things. But those same conservatives who were saying that when Obama was president were condemning Obama for doing those things. So the principled position is to say it's bad no matter who the president is.
Right. It's a tapestry of suck. It's all interwoven together, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
It's continuous. Well, Jonah, we're running up against our time here, but
I'm sorry if I've been rambling. I
No. We encourage that sort of behavior, but we do want to let you get back to editing your book and getting your editor out of hell there. But thank you so much for being with us today. It's been fantastic.
It's been an honor and a privilege. Thank
now,
you.
Now we do have one more piece of business, however, that we must conclude before we release you. And this is our only gotcha question.
LaMotta. I just assumed you wanted to ask me what my favorite sensual dance was, but okay, go on.
Well, that's a good one, actually. No, but this is actually it's a question of vital cultural importance, and it's one on which Jay and I disagree strongly. And
yeah, one of you is wrong. I'll just be clear about that.
Right. I think that that is the case. Both of us agree that one of us is wrong. We need to ask you this, though, and we trust you as a keen critic of the culture and an observer of American society at large. So let me just lay this on you here. Would Tom Hardy be a good James Bond?
I would enjoy greatly watching Tom Hardy as James Bond.
Yes.
That does not necessarily mean he would be a good James Bond. Right? I mean, are we talking about the platonic ideal of what a good James Bond is?
I think we are.
He could, I don't know the answer to that. He could go so weird with James Bond, doing his sort of mumbling thing, that it would be so off-putting. It's sort of like, in Top Chef, if you call something like a souffle or risotto, and then you deliver something that is delicious, but not a souffle or a risotto, they almost always kill you for it because you have to actually live up to what you said you were calling it. And I never understand why these chefs who know this don't just call it something else.
They get too creative and yeah.
So the problem with Hardy as James Bond is, would he make a friggin' phenomenal, badass British Secret Service character? Yes. Undeniably, yes. Would it be a risotto, right? Would it be James Bond? I think, look, I think you can find a lot of actors, Dom DeLuise would make a really interesting James Bond, but it wouldn't be James Bond in the platonic ideal. So I hope I've satisfied the Kobayashi Maru aspect in both answering it and not answering it.
You have very, very well, sir. I'm going to chalk this up to no.
Oh, no.
Bond, which
sorry.
Points for me. Point to me.
Huh. Yeah.
Victory is mine.
I can edit this, so I can just sit there. I can sit there and say, we're talking it up on a yes.
All righty, Jonah. Now we release you.
I appreciate
that. Wild, sir. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, Jonah. Appreciate it.
Yep. Bye.
All right. And that's going to do it for that was one heck of a explanation about James Bond and Tom Hardy. That's like a whole new
see I like it because he outlined why you would think that Tom Hardy would make a good James Bond, and then he explained why you're wrong. That's why I liked his explanation.
Well, he didn't necessarily say I was wrong, but he just said, well, it doesn't matter. We'll sit here for another half an hour debating this. So, everybody, thank you so much for listening to The Fifth Estate. As we sign off, you know, go ahead, like I said, please, go out, give us a review, sign up to this podcast, go ahead and subscribe, tell your parents to subscribe, tell your friends to subscribe, tell everybody you know to subscribe so you can continue listening to great stuff like this. For Jay Caruso, I am Jay Caruso. For Neil Dewing, I'm Jay Caruso, and we will see you next time here on The Fifth Estate.